FIS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is Senior Editor Chris Sheridan.
While tensions are continuing to flare in the Red Sea and in other shipping lanes that are critically important to global trade, this is a topic that we have picked up and discussed numerous times over the years when it comes to the reordering of the post-World War II order, where countries like China, Russia, Iran, and others are likely to increase pressure on the U.S. and its allies within their respective regions. Joining us to help explain the big picture when it comes to the wider geopolitical outlook is Edward Gustley, Managing Director of Panita Capital Advisors, located in Jakarta, Indonesia. So, Ed, before we get into what's happening in the Red Sea and other strategically important areas, let's talk about the broader context that a lot of these geopolitical events fit into, which is the breakup or fraying of the post-World War II international order, where the U.S. largely acted as the sole hegemonic power. We're now witnessing numerous challenges to this across various fronts as we move into perhaps a less geopolitically stable but more multipolar balance of power. What say you?
There's a lot there to unpack, but just in the South China Sea, where we have the tensions continually to rise, there's over $3 trillion of annual maritime commerce that passes through those waters. China seeking to extend, it's called Red Dash Line, 900 miles off its southern coast. And so this is a flashpoint that's been covered more frequently, but it's been going on since the 1970s with China and the 10 economies that make up Southeast Asia, also known as ASEAN. So that is a key flashpoint. When we see what's happening, obviously, in the Red Sea, the configuration of Iran, China, Russia, in its sphere, the expansion of the BRICS now, including 10 countries, this is all to counter what many perceive as an overdominance of the U.S. dollar, both in the energy markets and in commerce, and to find a way to transition that into where, again, essentially where 45%, I believe, of the global GDP is now traded among the BRIC member countries. And so this rebalancing is, to your point, of a reemergence of a, quote, multipolar world. But how that is done in a smooth or credible fashion that does deepen the bonds of trust among those on different sides of the chessboard is what is critical right now. And what we're seeing is everyone vexing and posturing and trying to push as far as they can their positions to see what is the counter reaction or alternatively no reaction at all into this realignment. And so it is real. It's going to make the next, I would say, 10 years quite challenging and complicated. Whether it will flare up in areas, I think that's a given, but how that is addressed to maintain global market stability and certainly regional stability among these various economies, which have mostly benefited from the U.S. position over the last 70 years in trying to assemble and build democratically elected market economies, is going to be a proving ground as to how we move forward.
That's for sure. And as you mentioned, you know, in the South China Sea, critical area, very strategically important, $3 trillion that passed through that region in maritime trade, key flashpoint. Same thing with the Red Sea, which estimates put, you know, 12 to 15% of global trade passing through there. And obviously we have the ongoing Houthi attacks on numerous international ships and shipping lines, which are having to divert away from the Red Sea and go around Africa, which is much more costly. It's much cheaper to go through the Red Sea. So there's a number of things that are happening here. And the question is whether or not these geopolitical events, the turbulence that we see currently, if these are one-time events, or again, if this is expected to be a sort of ongoing pattern that we're likely to see for years to come as this post-World War II international order realigns itself. And as you correctly pointed out, we are seeing a massive reshuffling of power among global economies. And China, the BRICS nations, they are increasingly a much larger share of global trade of the global economy versus the U.S. Let's talk a little bit about the Red Sea and what you see going on there, since that is the critical flashpoint currently, what are some of the key points that you're looking at when it comes to the importance of the Red Sea in this broader framework?
Well, the majority of China trade comes through the Suez Canal and through the Red Sea. Very little passes through that is U.S. aligned. So when we look at the Gulf states and certainly the Red Sea area, what we're seeing is, in our opinion, it appears to be that the U.S. is gradually pulling away from being the police of that region, simply because it is not dependent on the oil coming from the Gulf states. China is. And it's not dependent on the trade flowing through the Suez Canal. Again, China is. So what we're seeing is a flexing of muscle among the various players within the Gulf states as to who's going to be potential leaders in this area. And so you have a jockeying for position. Obviously, Iran through its proxies trying to get some access to the Mediterranean or through the Red Sea and beginning to move some of its naval assets there. Again, potentially just collecting tolls to keep the peace, or maybe as a proxy for China in order to keep the peace. You have China's naval vessels also parked in the region. As you know, Djibouti and Somalia are very active in and Eritrea and hosting bases for the various maritime powers in that region. So it's very active, but they're all trying to posture and position as to who at the end of the day is going to be the gatekeeper. And the U.S. has maintained that gatekeeping role, quid pro quo, continue to buy our U.S. Treasury bonds, and we'll continue to make sure that the sea lanes and commerce flows appropriately without too much interruption. We are seeing that interruption as we speak, and I think that is self-evident not only in the Gulf, but also what we're seeing as posturing and positioning and some of the kerfuffles that we are beginning to understand and the reasons why within the South China Sea. 65% of trade passes through the Malacca Strait, which is between Malaysia and Indonesia. That is a choke point. But there are also other choke points around the world that, again, if you look at the alliances of vested interests, it all has to deal with ensuring that you have the flow of commerce and the control of energy and the markets that they serve to protect. And so it's not real too much rocket science to figure out where these potential battle lines are being drawn and where military and naval assets will be allocated to ensure that those flows of commerce and energy take place. So that's what we're seeing, how that plays out. I think we're seeing it playing out in real time. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to be hopefully cooler heads will prevail, that there will be some new form of alliances that will have the bonds of trust to ensure that they're not disrupted from a commercial or energy transition standpoint. But that remains to be seen. So we are in a very fluid situation, and I think everyone is watching those markets as we speak. One of the things and the challenges that we have is the U.S. position has been, we'll provide safety and security to your countries, just continue to buy our U.S. Treasury bonds. And at what point does that begin to tail off? And we're beginning to see in the bond auctions, particularly at least China, buying less of U.S. Treasury bonds as they build up their own capabilities of security and defense. Now, if you look at the regions, whether it's Latin America or Southeast Asia or even Africa, you have to begin to look at what is the capability of these various regions and countries to defend themselves. And that comes down to, well, who are they going to turn to? Are they going to turn to the U.S. and continue to foster that relationship of buying U.S. Treasury bonds implicitly for the security and protection that the U.S. can provide, particularly with the dollar as still the reserve currency and where a majority of all global trade is done in dollars? Or are they going to begin to defuse some of that dependency and begin to look elsewhere? And of course, China would like to play that role. China and Russia, through the BRICS organization, would like to expand that alliance and bring more of those countries into their sphere of influence to placate the U.S. position in the world in that regards. I don't think this is going to happen overnight. I think we're looking at the next 25 years as how this plays out. But in the meantime, what should the U.S. be doing? I think part of it is looking at how it shores up its own budgetary needs and its debt financing. It should begin to look at back to the Monroe Doctrine of the Western Hemisphere. Where are we having slippage in our engagements with Latin America? Southeast Asia is still critical, and I'll give you a reason why it's still critical. If we go back to the 1930s, when President Roosevelt came into office, his National Security Council at that time was commissioned to understand the impact of Japanese imperialism over not only Manchuria, which was China, but all of the South Asian economies. And 3 years later, prior to the Pearl Harbor incident, he came back and said, "Mr. President, why these spice islands, predominantly Indonesia, but the Philippines, Thailand, Malaysia, and the likes, matter to U.S. interests is because Rosie the housewife will open her kitchen cupboards and 65% of the contents won't be there." So it's still a resource play. And this is why the U.S. has come back to begin to increase its engagement, at least in Southeast Asia, to placate the adventurism that China is beginning to be more aggressive on its fronts. It has supported Japan going from its constitutional protocols of strictly for self-defense reasons, its military, to being more proactive and getting back to having a full maritime naval presence and partnering with and aligning with Japan, Australia, India, and the UK in ensuring that there is some degree of overlap and engagement of these various nations to ensure that stability is maintained in the waters over Southeast Asia and the resources that it represents. And to give you an example, for Indonesia's sake, Indonesia represents the largest nickel reserves in the world, including cobalt, manganese, lithium. All of these go into EV battery production. And so now we have a vested interest to make sure that those flows of critical metals and rare earth metals are flowing into, quote, the new economy, renewables and the likes. For China to dominate that, which they do right now in the export and the restriction of exports of rare earth elements to the U.S. is very concerning. And then you have natural gas and oil deposits within the South China Sea. And as I mentioned earlier, China extending its territorial waters 900 miles south of its southern border, overlapping half a dozen of the ASEAN countries and their economic zones. This is reason to be of concern and why the U.S. is looking strategically at pivoting and transitioning its maritime assets away from the Gulf and allocating them more toward Southeast Asia waters, in addition to beginning to look at ways to allocate its resources to Latin America from the various Belt and Road Initiative projects that China has continues to sign agreements and to build out across Latin America. And I'll give you an example. China is building a very large seaport that will connect intermodal across South America through rail and highway lines. And the reason they're building that is to essentially extend trade to Western Africa that doesn't have to go through the Panama Canal. So they are working diligently on finding ways and routes away from where the choke points or where the U.S. naval presence is and engaging parts of Latin and South America to make that happen.
You know, Ed, I want to throw one point out at you, and I think that this is an important point to consider, and that's the fact that this is leading to an increase in the price of shipping. We have seen in recent weeks with the Houthi attacks and the diversion of global trade and shipping around Africa, you know, this has led to higher ocean freight rates, delayed goods, longer shipping times. If we are seeing this realignment of globalization of the post-World War II international order, if that is beginning to fray, This does have a meaningful impact on shipping globally across these various choke points. Do you think that this could be leading to a higher than average inflation rate than what we've gotten accustomed to, you know, particularly in that post-2008 period where we were barely eking out, you know, 1-2% or so on the official inflation rate here in the U.S.?
That's a great question. I think it really has to do with where are our supply chains and the cost component with regards to the supply chains and who has the means to escalate prices that we're paying for in the supermarket and retail and anything else, which is, you know, consumer driven. So if we're spending the next several years onshoring and reshoring various manufacturings that are being pulled out of China, most of those are not necessarily going to the US, but they're going to Mexico. Well, then you have geographical proximity with regards to mitigating any disruptions with regards to shipping costs. However, you also need to have a degree of diversification of supply chains to ensure that you get best value for money and no one has you over a barrel as to what they can charge you in prices, which should pass us through on an inflationary standpoint, or alternatively, you have decreased demand for those components. So I would have to take a look and really understand each of the industries and sectors and what their supply chains are to begin to kind of ferret out what are the inflationary pressures within those supply chains. Again, most of the inflation that we've seen has been the issuance and printing of money, and most of that money has gone into the financialization of assets, not necessarily into plant machinery and equipment, which are economic multipliers and builders. So, well, again, I don't have an easy answer, but I would say this, that at the end of the day, it's best to be owning hard assets. And in other words, when I say hard assets, things that if you dropped it on your foot, it's going to hurt. And that can be arable land, precious metals, anything that has a productivity aspect to it. Those means and methods of producing goods and services are going to maintain their value regardless of what the inflationary aspects are. And, you know, if that is going to be the case, that we begin to see a decoupling of the U.S. dollar with regards to its trading dominance and a weakening of the dollar vis-a-vis its over leverage with the amount of debt that we have to service, then you have to be starting to look at things that actually produce value regardless of either what currency they're priced in or the impact that they may have with regards to inflation.
One point I do want to discuss with you before we go, and that is a point that Jeff Christian actually just brought up on our show recently in terms of the expected political turbulence for 2024. Obviously, we do have widely anticipated elections here in the U.S. in November, presidential elections, but there's also a large number of elections that are going to be taking place all over the world this year, including where you're located in Indonesia. Tell us a little bit about that and how this could impact, you know, the political or geopolitical landscape this year.
So Indonesia will have its presidential elections and overall parliamentary elections on Valentine's Day, February 14th this year. There are three candidates in the running. And if any candidate gets 50 plus 1%, they obviously are chosen as president. If not, then you have a runoff a few months later to determine among the remaining top two candidates who will be president. Indonesia's has run very effective and transparent elections since the fall of Suharto, who ruled for 32 years back in 1998. It's the largest direct elections in the world, the number of voters. 200 million, if not more, will be voting in this election. The average age is for voters is below 30, and they take their vote very seriously. And what I've appreciated watching these past elections, and a presidential election is for a five-year term, but the level of transparency and detail down to the community level, and let me explain it, it's kind of like how we grew up in our neighborhood where you would go down to the local elementary school and your name would be on a roster, and that would determine if you're eligible to vote, and you would show your ID and they would verify that and you could go in the voting booth and away you go. Well, Indonesia follows a similar pattern of local elections in local communities. And what they take very seriously is the local community polices who gets to vote. And what I mean by that is anyone who is not identified in person from that community is escorted away. And you think about the level of detail that has to take place in the administration. You're talking, you know, 14,000 islands across the world's largest archipelago, stretching from New York to LA along the equator. Of those 14,000, close to 7,000 have populations who vote. And so you're pulling these ballot boxes by land, air, and sea and consolidating them into a process that determines, you know, elected officials. And I would have to say that Indonesia gets very, very high marks in administering that and is applauded for making sure that it's transparent and fair. And in fact, President Jokowi of Indonesia met with his counterpart, President Marcos of the Philippines, to recertify their both security and their cooperation engagements with regards to the South China Sea, energy supplies, and also deepening that border cooperation among the Philippines and the Indonesia to mitigate any adventurism that China might take to dominate the region.
Yeah, certainly. And as Jeff Krishna pointed out, in addition to the U.S., Indonesia, Taiwan, we also have India, Mexico, and a number of other countries. I believe it's in over 50 countries as a whole this year that are going to be having elections, and that amounts to in excess of 60% of global GDP. So like you said, you know, some of these elections are very critically important. And as always, I appreciate you coming on to our show to discuss some of these events that we see. That being said, do you mind telling our listeners the best way that they can find out more about Panita Capital Advisors and what you're involved with in Jakarta, Indonesia?
The easiest way for people to find out about us is through our website, and that is Panita Cap, PENIDACAP.com, Panita Cap. We've been operating in Indonesia for over 30 years. I'm coming up on my 32nd year in Indonesia. It's been a fascinating opportunity and area to learn about. When I first came here, per capita income was about $250. Today, Indonesia's per capita exceeds 5,000, which for listeners would mean that you were starting off on your salary at 25,000 and now you're making $500,000, and that's for every man, woman, and child in America. So there's been a lot of progress made for Indonesia. At that time when I came, the economy, GDP was less than $100 billion. Now Indonesia is the largest economy among the 10 ASEAN members at over $1 trillion. So a lot of progress has been made in 30 years. It's the largest democracy after the United States. And the population per mean is below the age of 30. It adopts technology faster than any other country in the world. Most people have not walked into a bank because they've been doing online banking for almost 10 years. So it's very dynamic, very interesting. What our focus has been in these past 30 years is on the strategic deployment of capital benefiting these growth opportunities, both in Indonesia and among the 10 economies of ASEAN, which right now represents close to 680 billion people and a good percentage of global GDP. So for your listeners who don't have an interest in this part of the world, you might want to start to take a look at it because its position is rising and like-minded, market-oriented, democratic economies are trying to be supportive of it to ensure that it's able to grow and prevail in this very, very turbulent time in the world.
Well, once again, we've been speaking with Edward Gustley, Managing Director of Panita Capital Advisors, located in Jakarta, Indonesia. The website is panitacap.com. www.thesouthchinasea.com. Ed, always a pleasure to speak with you. We definitely look forward to having you on the show in the future. If you have any questions or feedback on what we discussed today, or if you'd like to get in touch with us at Financial Sense Wealth Management, feel free to check out our new website, financialsensewealth.com, or you can give us a call at 888-486-3939. For FS Insider, I'm Chris Sheridan. Thanks for listening.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.